We have some more questions before we move off to a different topical paragraph. Commissioner.
To be clear, in terms of the permitted activity discussion that you were having with the judge, whether what you were suggesting was the original proposition, I think, in Ms. Dicey's brief of evidence for a permitted activity rule?
Yes, Commissioner.
Is that what it is you're suggesting?
Yes.
So I just need a minute to find that.
I think it's page 78 of Ms. Dicey's evidence, Commissioner.
Right, thank you. I'll just turn that one up. So just before we turn to how this might be addressed, I was just trying to remind myself in the break about certificates of compliance and how they work. So is the taking of water and damming and things, is that part of the certificate of compliance process to the standard requirements for a certificate of compliance
If a certificate were sought?
Yes. If a certificate were sought.
Yes.
Or perhaps another way is, can you seek a certificate of compliance in relation to a take in use damming and diversion permit or permits?
Well, if there were a permitted activity rule that authorised it, then the answer to that would be yes.
Yes, okay. So that's fine. So then the next question is, what if the plan gets changed and you'd require a consent to do what you would otherwise have been doing as a permitted activity under your certificate of compliance? What happens then?
If a rule was introduced that required a consent to be sought, then the existing permitted activity could be exercised under Section 20 capital A of the Act, which contains transitional provisions for dealing with when an activity ceases to be permitted and requires a consent.
Right, so I think there might be a 6 month time period in there, but I guess my question relates to the transitional arrangement and when does it kick in? Does it kick in from the time of notification, or does that rule need to be operative?
My recollection is it's when it's operative, Commissioner. Yes, my understanding of how Section 20 capital A works is that the activity can continue until the new rule is operative, and then we've got 6 months from the date that it's operative to apply for a consent under the rule. So if the Land and Water Regional Plan contains a rule which says that a consent is required for a given activity, once that rule... And assuming that there's overlap between the duration of the permitted activity rule, then we've got 6 months from the date that that's operative to reapply.
And that doesn't give you any priority in terms of where you are in the queue for water, or does it?
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, when can you come back to us about that? So the proposition is that if all replacement and deemed water permits are permitted under the plan change, if there is a new land and water plan, those activities which require, as a rule in that plan, require those same activities to obtain resource consent, then any relative priorities which might exist as between consent holders now is lost. That's the proposition. When can you come back about that?
Yes. Well, I can come back to you in the morning.
After lunch?
Yes.
Yep, good. Right. Any more questions?
I think well, yes, I just wanted to understand how this permitted activity regime that is in Ms. Dicey's evidence might work. So is this proposition to be administered in a way where individual consent holders just come in to the Regional Council with their application for a certificate of compliance, and the Regional Council then just goes down these conditions and works out whether each one is met in order that it can then issue the certificate of compliance?
I had not anticipated that applicants would be seeking certificates of compliance. They are simply entitled to rely on the scope of the rule to exercise rights under the rule.
Well, I guess where I'm leading to is how workable is some of what is in here. For example, there's been quite a lot of discussion, hasn't there, about things like existing requirement. I'm looking at three.
Yes.
Existing requirement, condition, or priority status.
Yes.
Applying to the exercise of a permit under this rule shall continue to be legally binding, for example.
Yes.
And how so, might you see that being administered?
Well, simply that the terms on which the permit is currently held are effectively standards in the plan that a person exercising the activity has to comply with. So what the purpose of the exercise was to create a mirror image from the current permit terms and express those as standards for permitted activities.
And I see in V, it's indicating if there's a minimum flow limit.
Yes.
That would need to be met as well. So
yes.
If the Regional Council made minimum flow limits operative after your certificate of compliance had been issued,
yes.
Presumably you'd have to go and apply for another certificate of compliance to show that you were according with that, would you?
Well, remembering that there are already regulations that require the reporting of takes, and so the data already exists for the Regional Council to investigate and monitor whether a minimum flow limit is being complied with from the from the monitoring regulations. So it wasn't anticipated that there would be a need to apply for a fresh certificate of compliance if a minimum flow were implemented. It's simply the case that those exercising permitted activities would be required to comply with it as a standard to which the permitted activity is subject to.
So you're imagining that the certificate of compliance then might just repeat V, for example, to show that if the regime changes, then you're still subject to operative minimum flows.
Again, we weren't anticipating that certificates would be sought in any event. So my understanding of the Canterbury Gun Club case is that a certificate of compliance doesn't protect you from a subsequent legal obligation that comes to pass. So it's simply an operation of law that a minimum flow, which pertains to a catchment, would bind rights exercised under the proposed rule.
And just looking at two, the permitted activity water take,
yep.
The water's only to be used for the purpose authorised in the permit. Now, is it clear in a lot of these permits what the purpose authorised actually is?
Not in some permits, no, Commissioner, it isn't. there are ranges of permits where the purpose is clear, such as in the where water is to be used for the purposes of hydrogeneration, or alternatively where purpose specifies that it's for irrigation purposes. So there will be cases where it is abundantly clear that the permit authorises only a particular use, but particularly a lot of the older permits, Commissioner, I accept that that's not going to be apparent.
So then how would you apply to in that situation where the permit's silent on it?
Well, in my submission, two wouldn't be wouldn't affect the exercise of the permitted activity if no purpose is stated on the permit, but only where it is.
Right. And the only one I think I haven't mentioned is 1V. Which is referring us to methods.
Yes. Well, so that's been overtaken by withdrawing the relief that seeks a change to the provisions of the operative plan. So we should read that as a reference to the 10A4 schedule rather than schedules in the operative plan.
Okay. Thank you. That did help with clarifying that.
In the new land and water plan, if the plan does find that there has been over allocation, what is the over allocation of one or more attributes in relation to a water body where the taking of water is permitted for those persons who are presently exercising deemed permits or replacement permits? So the proposition now is that there is found to be over allocation. Can those persons, and secondly, that there is a rule introduced into the Land and Water Plan requiring resource consent be sought, requiring all permits to take and use water to do so via resource consent? What is the situation in relation to those water bodies where there is over allocation? Can persons who are currently, who is proposed to take water as a permitted activity and then seek resource consent where that water body, sorry, it's a bit jumbled, where that water body is over allocated, can they do that, or does the NPS preclude that?
I don't know whether the NPS precludes that. My submission is that if a rule in the Land and Water Regional Plan precludes the granting of resource consents to take water in catchments that have a particular difficulty, for example, they don't meet a national bottom line, then the preclusion operates by dint of the Land and Water Regional Plan.
Okay.
So what we're anticipating is that the Land and Water Regional Plan would do two things. It would introduce a suite of rules to manage consents going forward, but it would also revoke Plan Change 7 at the same time, so that there would be a... otherwise, you've got two sets of rules applying at once.
If it is... it's also a job for over lunch then. I want to know what does the MPS have to say about... resource consents for the taking, using, damming or diversion of water from water bodies which are determined under the MPS processes for FMUs to be over allocated. Can a resource consent nonetheless be sought? So I want to know what the MPS says about it.
Okay.
Because I am concerned, without having to check myself, I am concerned that if all current water holders, their activities are fully permitted, and subsequently it is found that there is over-allocation, that rather than taking advantage of any grandfathering provisions which could apply under the MPS to bring the water bodies back into a full state of health, whatever that means for the community, they will not be able to take advantage of grandfathering. They simply will not be able to take water. And that's the effect of the MPS. That's the proposition that I'm putting to you.
I understand the proposition.
And if that is correct, I just would like to know whether that's correct, because it just seems a remarkably risky proposition for your client.
Well, I confess that I have not turned my mind to that circumstance, and if it transpires that we accept that a permitted activity rule loses the potential for granting consents under the Land and Water Regional Plan compared to a similar controlled activity rule, then we'll deal with that with the scope of our relief.
You'll need to deal with it rapidly. So come back to us after lunch. Now, if you need more time, let us know.
Yes.
It's not the court's purpose to take away relief from your client, but we need to understand the costs and benefit to the region in proceeding in the way that your client wishes to proceed, by making all deemed and replacement, all deemed and existing water permits permitted. Because we think there are costs and benefits, and we think they are risks. And so we wish to understand the implications of proceeding in that way. Now, Ms. Dicey does not support a permitted activity. So to whom in your witness team are we to direct our questions, or indeed councillor to direct their questions about the permitted activity rule? Because there's been an amount of evidence given by other parties in relation to the same, raising issues about the same.
Well, I mean, Ms. Dicey will be able to answer questions about the costs and benefits of the rule that were included in her original evidence, or some approximation of it. But you're right to observe that she now accepts Mr. Rensel's version of the controlled activity rules as an acceptable outcome. So, we'll reflect on the issues that you've raised about the potential concerns of reconsenting under the NPS over lunchtime and report to the court then.
I'd be grateful for that. The court in raising the question, and I'd have to say again, is not because the court has a definitive view, but the court is concerned to understand the footing that ORUG advances its case. And so we do so in relation to permitted activities, to understand ourselves better what the implications are if there is a rule introduced for permitted activities, what the long-term implications or short to long-term implications are. We did so in relation to the scope of evidence, again, not to direct our ORAG into any direction, but again to understand that with accepting that reject the plan change, you know, is within scope. If there were difficulties with the balance of ORAG's case, then there were some significant risks to ORAG in proceeding on that footing. And as a matter of fairness, we are raising these issues, which you can rebut, and we'll move on with that in mind, or reflect and change your position. And again, whatever you have to say, we'll move on. But you understand the risks.
Yes.
The risks are, there are risks, we suspect there's risks on permitted activities, and we wish to hear more from ORAG about that. Yes. We suspect that there are risks in terms of scope, because if ORAG is without scope, ORAG, except for the rejection submission, is without relief. Because if there's no scope, then I have no jurisdiction.
Mm. Well, I think I can...
So that is why we are raising these issues.
Yes. Mm. And I understand the points that you're making, and I think it's fair to signal that in advancing a permitted activity status, ORAG had not understood that that would be disadvantageous when re-consenting under the Land and Water Regional Plan. And if on further reflection we find that it is, then we'll deal with it.
Right. Well, it's a matter for you. You're entitled to pursue the permitted activity status, and we will think about that as part of the relief, which is in the mix of relief amongst all of the parties. Whether it is disadvantageous to ORAG per se is only one consideration. It may well be disadvantageous to the region in general if a wide swathe of farmers are unable to undertake their current farming activities because they find themselves outside of the allocation limit and the action plans and so forth under the NPS. And so again, that's something that we need to consider. Is there a risk of that or not?
Yes, we'll reflect on that over lunch and report this afternoon. Now, I think we've probably dealt with paragraphs 39, 40 and 41.
We'll just quickly read it for ourselves.
I want to turn now to the non-complying pathway. The drafting now proposed by Mr. De Pelsmaker removes the difficulty created for the policy gateway, which included the no more than minor formulation, but it has created a new problem by establishing an avoid threshold for consents longer than 6 years. Mr. De Pelsmaker confirmed that the proposed new drafting was to effectively close the door on there being scope to grant consents for more than 6 years. The reason why it is submitted that the no more than minor test is problematic is understandable when one asks what the environment is being evaluated against the application. Here is where the High Court's decision in Ngāti Rangi becomes problematic for applicants. Ngāti Rangi is clear that the comparison environment under Section 104(1)(a) is the environment absent the exercise of the permits that are at issue. And so in an application such as Manaherikia Catchment Group, the environment against the no more than minor test applies as one absent any irrigation in the catchment whatsoever. Nor does it include water stored in dams. It is most unlikely that any application can pass the no more than minor test when compared with the notional naturalised flows. There is also a logical problem that farms and the communities that support farms would not exist under a naturalised flow regime either, So the intellectual exercise of imagining a world absent the permits being renewed has its limitations. It is difficult to see what policy imperative is served by the Section 104D jurisdictional barrier. There is nothing in the NPSFM 2020 that signals that applications to take water should not be decided upon their merits. Nor is there anything in the Minister's recommendation to that end. The Minister described the problem in this way. And it may assist to have the Minister's recommendation open, because I'm going to...
Yeah. Can you remind me where that is?
It is Volume 5, Tab 12C.
Slow your pace just a little bit.
Sure.
All right, 12, got it, I think.
So we're on Common Bundle page 1478. And what you will see is that if we go back to 1477, you will see that the Minister discusses Professor Skelton's recommendations. And then, under the heading Urgent Need for an Interim Planning Framework, and that discussion about the need for the planning framework goes over from 1477 to 1478. And what I want to draw the Court's attention to is the fourth paragraph, where the Minister says, in my view, long terms for these new consents would be unwise, as they would lock in unsustainable water use, inhibiting the Council from effectively implementing the outcomes of its intended new regional policy statement and land and water regional plan. And as a consequence, then, he made his recommendation, which is the subparagraph 3, to prepare a plan by 31 March that will provide an adequate interim plan. I mean, I don't need to read it to the Court. It's there. It is only in the following paragraph, that is the one immediately following recommendation number 3, that the notion of a maximum term 5 years is suggested as an interim measure until sustainable allocation rules are in place. It is submitted that the ORC has lost sight of the problem. What the Minister was concerned about was unsustainable water use. That term can only be understood by reference to the NPSFM 2020. There is nothing in the Minister's recommendation or in my submissions his reasons to suggest an intention to close off all merit-based assessments of water permit applications at all. That the door might be left open for applications that address the requirements of the NPSFM 2020 directly, and thus in my submission cannot be described as unsustainable, is evident from the Minister's policy witness, Ms. Coheri. And I wanted
to... Oh, you've got a problem, footnote 17.
Yes.
Yeah.
I can't find Ms. Coheri's evidence in the transcript at all.
All right. Well, I haven't been looking at the transcript, my confession. There's enough to read without reading the transcript, but I will. Just flag that. Ms. Coheri's, all of the transcripts missing from Ms. Coheri? Just some
Yes, Ms. Coheri's evidence isn't in the index or isn't there at all.
I'll follow up on that,
Your Honour. Investigate. Cheers.
ORUG submits that if a form of Plan Change 7 is to be approved, It should include a fully discretionary activity pathway to enable applications that respond to important MPS FM 2020 considerations and to be decided on their merits. The reasons for this are that applicants can then be assured that their permit replacement application will be considered on its merits rather than fail as a result of a jurisdictional barrier. And secondly, the matters that are relevant are not limited, if it's fully discretionary, and so that addresses concerns raised by Ngāi Tahu in relation to the operative regime, and you'll recall the last chance decision referred to by Mr. Ellison and in my friend's submissions.
Can you just pause there a second? So your first line, paragraph B, the matters that are relevant are not limited. You mean not limited in a way that a controlled activity rule is, or something else?
No, not limited. I'll rewind. The court will remember Mr. Winchester's submissions and Mr. Ellison's evidence that last chance was a decision of an independent commissioner which suggested that the restricted discretion under the operative plan didn't adequately include cultural matters.
Well, it precluded consideration of cultural matters.
Yes.
Yeah, it's not a question of adequate. Didn't the decision maker find that they could not be considered as a matter of discretion?
No, my submission, that's too bold a reading of the last chance decision, because the commissioner did then go on to address the issue, but under the rubric of ecological and river values concerned from the hikikai species.
Okay, all right.
So he approached Māori through the a habitat lens rather than directly through a cultural lens.
Okay.
But in any event, if the rule was wholly discretionary, then questions of scope and relevance don't apply. Thirdly, as my C at top of page 14, the activity status carries no presumption in favour of either grant or decline. And fourthly, we now know that by June 2021, we will have a proposed regional policy statement that includes provisions to describe how the management of freshwater in the region will give effect to Te Mana o Te Wai. Applications heard after that notification date, which in my submission will be the vast majority, will be measured against that new proposed RPS. And as to that, the relevance of that to which I come. The rebuttal evidence of Mr. De Pelsmaker alerts the court to the council's intention to notify a proposed regional policy statement by June 2021. Evidently, the regional council has given a commitment to the minister to do so. This creates a difficulty for the court. A proposed regional policy statement is a mandatory relevant matter under Section 66 of the Act. Unless the court contemplates issuing its decisions on Plan Change 7 before June, then the court will be faced with the prospect of having a proposed regional policy statement that it must have regard to, but no party nor witness has presented any evidence about it or had the opportunity to make submissions in relation to it. The proposed regional policy statement will record the long-term vision for each FMU and describe how the management of freshwater will give effect to Te Mana o Te Wai. It is submitted that the Council's evidence about the lack of knowledge of the various rohe within the FMUs required to guide the granting of resource consents seems implausible when the Council itself has done sufficient work to formulate long-term visions for FMUs and describe how freshwater management within the FMUs will give effect to Te Mana o Te Wai. The real problem here is one of timing. The ORC is simply a couple of months away from being able to share that information with the court. This is unfortunate because the Minister's second recommendation was that was that the proposed regional policy statement be publicly notified by November 2020. Had the ORC complied with that recommendation, the court would have had the benefit of the proposed RPS and be able to evaluate the party's positions on Plan Change 7 against it. ORUG records that it regards itself as prejudiced by the Council's delay in notifying the proposed RPS. Its case for a substantive consenting pathway would be better understood when the Council's timeframes for implementing long-term visions for freshwater are known. And I just record that full Council meetings currently scheduled for the 26th of May and the 23rd of June, and presumably the RPS will be adopted at one of those to meet the notification deadlines.
If the Council does notify, resolves to notify the RPS and notifies the RPS, so proposed RPS, what are your submissions in relation to prejudice?
Well, if the court is then able to have regard to the RPS once it's been adopted for notification, then the prejudice falls away.
What's the process that entails?
I'm sorry?
What is the process that would entail? It wouldn't be me Googling the RPS, I don't think, so it must be something else.
No, no. Well, in my submission, it's incumbent upon the Regional Council to alert the court when a mandatory relevant matter arises that is new and the court hasn't received evidence about. So if and when that happens, my submission that it's the duty of the Regional Council to advise the court about that, and then the principles of natural justice follow about what the court then does with it, which is the parties will need to be heard.
All right. I will be making directions that the ORC respond and invite any other parties with a differing view to either yourself or the ORC to do likewise. As to the status and relevance of the any proposed RPS, should it be notified prior to the court releasing its decision, and these steps, as much as you might know them at this stage, steps to be taken to overcome any prejudice of any party. But in as much as it's not going to be notified this week, I think we can say that for a direction by the end of the week, ORC to come back. And then I'll open it up to other parties with the same or different view as to yourself and Mr. Page. Okay.
I want to come now to the relevance of evidence on galaxias. The court might have been surprised to receive such voluminous evidence about galaxia species in Otago in the context of a plan change of such limited scope as Plan Change 7 is intended to be. It is submitted that the significance of the galaxias evidence is to highlight that the law of unintended consequences applies to this plan change as it does to any other regulatory instrument. It is submitted the court needs to have confidence that it understands the consequences for critical endangered species of any decision that it makes under Plan Change 7. The evidence shows that the court can have no confidence that it can predict an outcome for galaxia species under a short-term permit regime. What we know from the evidence is this, that a significant threat to galaxia species in Otago rivers is trout. Under current flow regimes, galaxia species are present in habitat that trout cannot reach. Maintenance of flow regimes that keep trout out of Galaxia's habitats is currently critical to their survival. And changes to flow regimes under short-term permits potentially put Galaxia species at risk from trout predation.
Now, I hate to stop you here because you're mid subject matter, but I think I was told to rise at 12 so we could do some testing on the AVL.
Correct, Your Honour.
So we are going to take an adjournment. Should I let you finish? Yeah, we're just going to be cutting into the testing time required for that AVL link with your witness. So we'll rise and back here at 1 o'clock. Yep. And is it back here at 1 o'clock with Mr McIndoe?
That was the plan, Your Honour.
Or we're going to test Mr McIndoe, see if he's, you know, we can successfully establish the link. Do you want to finish your submission first and then bring him on? And I'm only asking you this because I know that Mr Hickey also has some time constraints about which I know nothing other than evidently he does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, those time constraints aren't today.
Oh, okay, good.
So he'll be with us for the day, certainly, and I think even tomorrow. Not tomorrow. Okay, he's off at conferencing tomorrow, apparently. So it would be ideal to take him today, and frankly, I don't mind if we park my submissions where they are, because the evidence is more important.
Yeah. Does anyone have any problems, Mr. Page, parking his submissions for the time being, calling his witnesses, interposing his witnesses?
Only in relation to the planning witness, so it would be of use to see where these submissions go prior to hearing from Ms. Dicey, but the technical witnesses can
yeah, no, it would, yeah. But I guess we can read ahead, at least. All right. Commissioner, have you got any views on that? Okay, well, it is what it is, said Donald Trump. And criticised by Michelle Obama for actually uttering that comment, so I shouldn't really say that, but it is the process. We've got to interpose Mr. McIndoe to get him on. We'd like to hear from him before he goes into conferencing tomorrow. So I'm sorry about that, Mr. Page. I'm very grateful that we can park you for the time being whilst we hear from your witnesses, and then come back to you as soon as we can, which will be in short order. All right, thank you.
All rise.